One day, about 10 years ago, Tom Rasher gets a phone call.
I got a call from this very nice guy named Jim Hogan from Hudson, Wisconsin. And I could tell from his voice that he was an older gentleman. But he told me that his stepfather liked to draw and that the family was looking for a museum that would become the repository of his stepfather's drawings.
These sorts of calls, by the way, almost never work out. In fact, rarely has Tom Rasher, who's a curator of prints and drawings at the Minneapolis Institute of Art, taken such a call and the artwork waiting at the other end of the line.
Normally, this is the kind of thing where you back away politely. But he seemed quite earnest about this, and I thought, what the heck? I might as well see what he's got.
Tom invites the man to the museum, and the guy sets down a couple of binders filled with reproductions of his stepfather's drawings.
I sat down with the binders and opened them, and I was astonished. Every turn of the page, I found one delightful drawing after another.
Many of the drawings are fairy tale illustrations made in pen and ink. Sprites, fairies, talking trees, little men sitting under toadstools, a grasshopper with a cello on its back. Tom had never encountered the work of an artist he hadn't heard of that was this enchanting. So he had to ask, who was this guy? And the stepson says,
Richard Holtshue.
Wait, who?
Richard Holtshue.
Yeah, me neither. But he really existed, Richard Holtshue. In Minneapolis and for a time in New York, and then in Minneapolis again. A guy who made hundreds of drawings and etchings and book illustrations in the 19-teens and 20s and 30s and 40s until he pretty much disappears. This is the Object Podcast, produced by the Minneapolis Institute of Art, showing The Shape of Time, Korean Art After 1989, starting March 23rd, tracing democracy's effect on the art, culture, and rising influence of South Korea. The Object is made possible by generous support from Ameriprise Financial, a proud supporter of the Minneapolis Institute of Art and committed to the future of art and culture in the communities they serve. Ameriprise Financial, helping people feel confident about their financial future since 1894. Today, a story about the things we don't see coming and the things we do. Can we make life more predictably surprising? Or do we just have to wait for it? It's the first episode of Season 6. I'm Tim Gehring. In 2001, a group of scientists decide to run an experiment on surprise. They sit 25 people down in front of a machine and tell them to open wide. And then the machine starts squirting fruit juice and water into their mouths. Sometimes it's nothing but fruit juice, squirt after squirt. Sometimes it's water, water, fruit juice, water, fruit juice, and some totally unpredictable pattern. And while this is happening, an MRI device is scanning the brains of these people to see how they're responding. Better, worse, about the same. Now, you might think people would like the steady stream of fruit juice, right? Because it's fruit juice. And they do. But what they really like is when the fruit juice comes unexpectedly. In fact, the element of surprise seems to intensify our emotions by about 400%. Pleasure is good. Unexpected pleasure, even better. Now, Tom Rasher is in his 50s when he gets this call out of the blue. Top of his field, drinking almost nothing but fruit juice, in other words. Working with art by Rembrandt and Durer, the best artists you can think of. But when someone he never heard of lands in his lab, and he's actually good, well, that's the best kind of fruit juice. And it only happens once a decade, he says, if that. You just have to wait for it. Well, enough about fruit juice. The stepson of Richard Holshute donates everything he has of the artist's work to the museum. Drawings, prints, printing plates, photographs, music he composed, Christmas cards he made for friends. The Minneapolis Institute of Art ends up with the largest collection of Richard Holshute anywhere in the world. Indeed, the only collection. But now Tom has another mystery. Who was Richard Holshute? And maybe more importantly, if you're going to make the claim that he's a great artist, why doesn't anyone seem to know who the heck he is? Let's go back to the 1880s or so, when the so-called golden age of illustration begins. Magazines are taking off. Books are becoming cheaper. Books for children especially are becoming popular because, well, children are becoming popular. For most of history, young people are seen as just small adults, right? Childhood has to be invented, and it is in the 1800s. Not because people are better off and kids don't have to work in the coal mine at age 4. They still do work in the coal mine. No, people start seeing kids differently because they start seeing sin differently. Original sin. The idea that we're all born already corrupt in God's eyes. During the Enlightenment of the 1700s, Rousseau, the French philosopher, is thinking about kids and this idea that they're born sinful and says, no, I don't think so. Children are innocent until corrupted by later experiences, which suggests that maybe they can be saved entirely with enough moral instruction, like, you know, children's books. So by the end of the 19th century, there's a whole new market for writers and illustrators, if you don't mind a little moralizing here and there. Now, if you're like me and grew up with Dr. Seuss, well, he's fine. He's cute. Everyone loves the Lorax, I hope. But 150 years ago, the stories are a little more substantial than Green Eggs and Ham. Fairy tales by the Brothers Grimm and Hans Christian Andersen. Peter Pan. Stories about growing up and flying right. Or else. Of course, the illustrations are richer too. There are guys like Arthur Rackham, an English illustrator whose gnarly trees with faces and arms make truffula trees look, well, like kids drew them. Rackham's trees look real. As real as trees with faces and arms can look. You look at his fairy tales, including the fairies themselves, their long hair flowing across the sky like some Art Nouveau angel, and you believe. And so, here's Richard Holshute, born in 1889, just as the golden age of illustration is getting underway. A little kid of 5 or 6, when Arthur Rackham comes out with his first books. In college, when Rackham's work is shown at the Louvre Museum in Paris. Holshute studies at the Minneapolis School of Art, now the Minneapolis College of Art and Design, and then spends 2 more years training with the Art Students League in New York. His drawings are a lot like Rackham's, filled with fairies and trees with faces and arms. He would seem to have a promising career ahead of him. But almost as soon as he's done with school, ready to make his way in the art world, World War I begins. And just like that, no one seems to believe in fairy tales anymore. No fairy tale, by the way, has ever ended with the prince going to work as an accountant, fiduciarily ever after. But this is what Holshute does. After freelancing as a commercial illustrator for a bit, he returns to Minneapolis and goes to work as a bean counter. Not for a museum or a designer or a furniture maker, something romantic like that, but an oil company. A company that eventually merges into Standard Oil, the biggest oil company in the world. Started by the richest man in the world, right? John D. Rockefeller. It's as if Geppetto walked out of his toy shop one day and signed on with Amazon. When I asked Tom Rasher about this, he says, well, Hoshu must have realized art is not a fairy tale.
I think that that is a true indication that he realized that he'd worked long and hard to train himself to be an artist and then found there was little demand.
Actually, Hoshu does make some art for his day job. The accountant moonlighting as an illustrator, drawing covers for Standard Oil's employee magazine. Maybe he gets paid extra. Maybe he's just being used after someone sees him doodling in a meeting and is like, hey, numbers guy can draw. But in any case, he does it more than once. Illustrations that have nothing to do with oil, as far as I can tell. Like a boy flying a kite and the wind in the form of a man blowing it along.
You and I might make doodles, and we might make patterns of parallel lines or crisscross lines or circles. But these are, in a sense, highly refined doodles in that his images are full of fantasy, but there's always a strong sense of patterning. And in a sense, making these things might have been a meditative exercise as well.
Hoshu actually seems to live in this fantasy land more often than not. And when he gets home, he puts his ideas on paper, burning the midnight oil well before midnight.
From what I understand, he didn't wait for the kids to go to sleep. He was kind of a remote character, and he would go into his own world even while the kids were still awake. This is something that was really important to him, so he would retire to his study or his workshop and get to work creating things.
Some of my favorite Hoshu drawings are his Christmas cards. These exquisite little images of Father Christmas striding across a winter landscape with snow-covered cottages, smoke wafting out the chimneys, elves with tall hats and long scarves, Christmas greetings from the Hoshus. If this seems like a lot of work, well, it is. But maybe you've heard of the Spugs, who are sort of like Luddites, only more constructive than destructive. I talked about them in the December episode, but hey, it's okay. Here's the short version. 1912, the Industrial Revolution is in full swing. Cheap gewgaws and gimcracks are everywhere. And around Christmas, people start to feel pressured to give presents to everyone they know, and some they barely do. So a few of them are like, no, enough. And they form the Society for the Prevention of Useless Giving, SPUG. Make your own Christmas gifts, your own cards, quality over quantity. Maybe Richard Hoshu is a SPUG, or SPUG adjacent. He does join an artist group called the Attic Club, which meets in the Central Library in downtown Minneapolis, where the Minneapolis Institute of Art got its start, with a few donated pieces in the attic there. You can almost picture him, setting aside the ledgers and the abacus, or whatever they used back then, putting on his black cloak and bowler hat, and strolling through the snow to hang out with these bohemian artists. Maybe bringing some of his cards to hand out. Christmas greetings from the Hoshus. Hoshu does show his work around town. The Beard Gallery in Minneapolis gives him solo shows. And the Minneapolis Institute of Art, in its exhibitions of local artists, displays his work. He also does illustrate some children's books in the Mother Goose mode, written by his sister. He is an artist, if also an accountant. And he's fine with that. He's fine. No chip on his shoulder. Hoshu retires from Standard Oil in 1954 at age 65 on the dot. And his coworkers write a poem in his honor. In all the years that you've been with us, reads one of the verses, you were nice to have around. You never carried a chip on your shoulder, but you always stood your ground. Okay, so maybe he's a little grumpy about it. At one point, the employee magazine wants to feature him, not just his art. But it takes a year of persuasion to get him to pose for the accompanying photo. And when he's asked about his family for the article, he says of his son, "Thank goodness he has no artistic inclinations." It's not just the money that's hard in art, right? It's what you have to do to earn it. And at some level, Holshoe probably knew he was never going to keep up with the trends. After World War I, art becomes serious and then abstract and then cold. By the time Holshoe retires, not even Disney is doing fairy tales anymore. There's the story of Kay Nielsen from Denmark. Moves to London just before the First World War, is right up there with Arthur Rackham as a top illustrator during the Golden Age, maybe the most famous artist in Scandinavia. And then, just before World War II, he goes to Los Angeles to work on the sets of a theatrical show at the Hollywood Bowl, and Walt Disney asks him to stick around, work on some storyboards. He does Fantasia, and then starts in on The Little Mermaid. But when the war hits, The Little Mermaid is shelved for the next 50 years, and Nielsen is let go. It's not until the 1960s that the medieval and fairies come back, and Nielsen's art drops into the lap of someone who thinks, this is incredible. But by then, Nielsen is dead, having spent the last 20 years in poverty. Holshoe doesn't have to change for anyone. There's a drawing on display right now in the galleries of the Minneapolis Institute of Art, a troop of elves marching through a forest with swords and spears and clubs, watched by a tree with eyes and arms. It's not from any recognizable fairy tale. It's not illustrating anything in particular, it would seem, except what's going on in Holshoe's imagination, which is maybe the upside of making art mostly for yourself. No one's going to tell you to stop drawing elves. Well, it isn't long after Tom Rasher acquires the collection of Richard Holshoe prints that he stages a show of it at the museum in 2016. And people love it, especially people with kids and people who are kids. As Tom puts it, Richard Holshoe, if not exactly famous, is at least no longer forgotten. People who may have been Googling Richard Holshoe for the past 15 years, without luck, are suddenly getting some info. So, maybe it was just a matter of time.
Things fall out of the sky. A couple of years after the exhibition, I received a note from a woman who said that she had a Richard Holshoe drawing. It's a signed drawing, and she wanted to give it to the museum.
Tom asked her how she got this drawing, right? Because remember, Holshoe was basically making these pictures just for himself and his friends. And that's when things get interesting.
I asked her about the drawing and about how she'd gotten it, and it turned into quite a story, and that she had recently bought a house in Virginia, an old house, something like 200 years old, that was had been used as a rental property previously. And while she was cleaning out the house, she noticed that shoved behind the chimney, there was a picture frame. So she pulled it out, and she realized that the glass was broken, and probably whoever owned it had shoved it behind there to protect the drawing, and then had simply forgotten it. And when the house was sold, the picture remained there.
I should say, too, that this isn't just an ordinary 200-year-old cottage. This is a 200-year-old cottage surrounded by trees, made out of brick, no windows in front, a roof almost entirely covered in moss and vines. It looks more or less like a Richard Holshoe drawing. Well, as it turns out, the woman just wants to solve the mystery of this drawing she found. She doesn't actually care for it. Quote, "I found the subject matter disturbing," she tells Tom, "and didn't want it hanging on the wall."
Although she didn't care for the drawing, I thought it was marvelous. It's another fairy tale drawing. It shows the story of the Erlkönig, which is I hadn't been familiar with it, but I was able to look it up, and it involves a child who's dying, and there's somebody who's trying to rescue the child. So they're riding through the woods on horseback at night, and the upshot of the story is that they don't make it, and the child dies before arrival at the destination.
Tom decides he really needs to contact the mysterious renter, because technically he probably owns this drawing. And as it happens, the woman and her husband had lived next door to the cottage for years before they bought it. So they know the renter, sort of. Quote, "We only saw the renter about 5 times in 5 years," she writes to Tom. "He only came on weekends, stayed at most a couple of hours and then left. He never stayed the night." So Tom tracks him down. A man named David from Washington, D.C. David, it turns out, had grown up in Edina, a suburb of Minneapolis. And his mother was a good friend of Richard Holeshoe, his bridge partner, in fact. She had commissioned a drawing from him as a birthday present for David when he was headed off to junior high school around 1945. And Holeshoe drew this supernatural tale of a boy attacked by the Elf King.
I don't know if I would have appreciated that when I was 12. If today somebody were to commission a drawing of this quality and offer and give it to me as a present, I would be overwhelmed. I'd be in tears. It's just such a remarkable thing to do. And Holeshoe clearly put a lot of time and thought into this. It's a very intricate work where you feel like you can touch every leaf of the foliage and get lost in the woods and feel the clouds swirling around you. The horse is, it's a bit of a carousel pony, but you feel him galloping through the night.
David had forgotten all about the picture stashed behind the fireplace, and he was fine with letting it go. I asked Tom if he thinks this is the last Holeshoe to drop.
Oh, no. I hope not. In fact, I hope that other pieces will turn up. And in fact, I know that there's one part of the family that has a substantial amount of material. And it would be interesting to see if that work will become available to the public in some form at some point so that people can see more of his wonderful creations. Really, when it comes right down to it, there are so many people like Richard Holeshoe alive today who do have their day jobs and who do go home and create at night. I work with many of them. I wish I were one of them. I just don't have that same impulse. I love art, but I'm not the one who's actually making it.
This has been the first episode of Season 6 of The Object Podcast, produced by the Minneapolis Institute of Art, with generous support from Ameriprise Financial. Check them out at ameriprise.com. Check us out at artsmia.org. New episodes will be dropping every month now. If you enjoy this show, please rate and review us, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. I'm Tim Gearing.